Now, when you look at Acts, try to find out what the Spirit was. You get the impression that this writer did his best to make it concrete. Not just a vague mood, but to be able to, he tried to document it and to say just what it did. As a matter of fact, it's often said that the book of Acts tells you much more about the operation of the Spirit than about the nature of the Spirit. What it was in and like itself, by itself, is not told. But you have a pretty definite idea of what it does, what effect it has. There are stories in Acts that speak of the Spirit as coming at a definite time to definite people. 10 minutes before they didn't have it, and now they've got it. And you can tell they've got it. It is something that doesn't come where sort of subterranean wave, but it comes upon you, and from that point on, it's obvious that you've got it. It often comes to people about the time that they are baptized. Again and again, the author of Acts likes to point out that either that they got the Spirit and they said, well, go ahead, now let's get baptized, or the other way around, they got baptized and while they were being baptized, the Holy Spirit came upon them. At any rate, there's a close temporal and almost external connection between baptism and the Holy Spirit. The story of Pentecost, of course, is the most famous of all the stories in Acts on the Spirit, and I hope it's known to you and freshly known to some of you, and therefore I don't need to but remind you that on a given day, which happened to be the certain Jewish feast, well known as the Feast of Pentecost, or one of the minor annual feasts of the year that occurred about 7 weeks after Passover. There were a group of people in Jerusalem, including the 11 disciples, plus the new substitute, I suppose, and maybe some other Christians. And they were met in a given place, and all of a sudden, there was a sound of a mighty rushing wind, and things came that you could see. They looked like tongues of fire, and they lit on these people. And much the surprise of the non-Christians present. It was a visible, audible experience. And then, going on to something even more definite, they began actually to speak. The first two things were passive. They didn't do anything. These things came on them. But after that, the Christians began talking. And they talked with tongues. We all talk with tongues, but I guess it's used in a little different sense. They spoke with tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. This also is one of the results of the Spirit. Do you see then that the Spirit affects the sight, I mean is visible, is audible, and is intelligible. At least it was here. It had a meaning, and also could be heard and could be seen. And I guess sort of felt, because the this terrific wind might very well have shaken the place. You'd have another one of your touches. Some of the early Christians, not the book of Acts, were not content with all these phenomena as showing the sensory and rational appreciability, perceptibility of the Spirit, but a group of them in the Syrian church thought that they ought to have the sense of smell involved. And they therefore said that on this occasion there was a sweet odor. That's not orthodox. I mean, that's not canonical, but it's just another step in the same direction, isn't it? Something like George Fox saying that all creation had a new smell, isn't it? They felt that this revolutionary experience that came to men presumably could be smelled as well as heard and seen. You got all your senses alerted by this experience. Now, the story goes on, and the reason it's told, I think, is this, that the author says that those that listened, who were not Christians, discovered that they could understand what was being said by these people speaking with tongues. And recognizing that they themselves were a very polyglot group, and he gives the names of 12 different nations, Parthians, Medes, Elamites, and dwellers in Mesopotamia, and people about Cyrene and whatnot. You get that list of nations there. And they said, we hear each one of us, these people speaking, in the language in which we were born. Quite an episode, wasn't it? At least prior to the days of simultaneous translation of the United Nations, it was. It was done without the benefit of electronic or electric devices and soundproof glass rooms or earphones and stationed translators. Even so, it's pretty nearly miraculous to me the way those men can do it down there, but they do. But this was an automatic miracle. So that without benefit of earphones, the Medes heard Peter talking in Median, and Elamites heard him talking in Elamite, and the people of Cyrene heard him talking in their language. That's the way the thing is described. A miracle, I'm sure. It was meant to be a miracle. And the Spirit, among its extraordinary manifestations, the earlier ones I mentioned, had this particular one of a remarkable philological experience. I'm never quite clear whether the miracle was operative on the speakers or on the hearers. It's a little difficult to analyze miracles anyhow, and I'm never quite clear about a little thing like that, but at any rate, as far as the hearers were concerned, their ears got their own national language. I think there's no doubt that that's what the book of Acts tends us to believe. And it puts this here at the beginning of the book as a remarkable and characteristic experience of the early church. It's a wholesale experience, a group experience, and it's put here, I think, deliberately at the beginning. It's so you might call it the conscious frontispiece of the book, and has intrigued Christians ever since, especially those of us who have to learn foreign languages. Very convenient, wouldn't it be, to have a dose of the Spirit like this? Talking to a man yesterday who said he spent 3 summers at Middlebury passing the language requirements for the PhD degree. What a waste of time if you could turn on this kind of thing. At any rate, the author of Acts is rather intrigued by this story. And once or twice later in the book, he refers to other new Christians receiving the Holy Spirit and speaking with tongues. Well, there's no lack of external concreteness in this story. And it's just characteristic of this author. If the Holy Spirit is something rather more intangible, if it's something of a inner spiritual experience, this author finds it important to convey his view of it by this rather massive, this concrete description of an event. And to a less degree in other places where he deals with it. You may remember that this is the same author who, when he describes the Holy Spirit coming upon Jesus at his baptism, he says, the Holy Spirit came in bodily form as a dove. The other gospel don't say anything about bodily form. But this author makes that extremely concrete, that event at the River Jordan with John the Baptist and Jesus. Well, some of you heard me discuss this from the literary point of view before this episode, and I won't dwell on it now. How did the author get this set of ideas? Well, where he really got it from, I think, was that there was something that happened in the early church, which is described by Paul in the 12th and 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, which was also called speaking with tongues, but which was a little different. Because there, the tongues are, I think, not definite human languages, but inarticulate phraseology, sounds that, because they were inarticulate, made noises that you couldn't make out, were called by the same name that you would call some foreign language. You ride in the New York subway and you hear all kinds of odd sounds, and you assume that those people are talking some language unfamiliar to you. You go to the meeting in Corinth, and you hear these people carrying on in this way, you assume that probably some other language than yours, and probably some other language not of men exactly, but of God or of angels, is being spoken by these enthusiastic and inspired Christian worshipers. In addition to that, the author of Acts shows elsewhere considerable interest in actual languages. You go through the book of Acts, you'll see that. He is interested. He's aware. He's an internationally minded person. He's aware of the fact that there are a dozen different languages and that people of a polyglot character have trouble in understanding each other. He has other places where people speak a language which some of the other persons in the story don't hear. Down there in Lycaonia, they talked, and Paul and Barnabas couldn't make out what they're talking about. And I expect down in Malta, they spoke a language which would also be difficult for them to understand, for Paul to understand. So that he's fully aware, no matter what he knows about this other kind of speaking with tongues, he's fully aware of the fact that there are such things as languages to be interpreted and understood. Furthermore, there was a story in the Old Testament, familiar to any Jew or early Christian, that at one time all the peoples of the world spoke the same language. And on an ill-fated day, when they misbehaved, they were compelled to speak, they suddenly found themselves divided into some, the Jewish said, 70 different languages. And the story of the Tower of Babel and its unhappy sequel would naturally enter into folklore and speculation. Then there's another story, not in the Old Testament, but in Jewish folklore, to the effect that when God on Mount Sinai spoke, giving the law, that all the nations of the world could understand it if they wanted to. The only ones that took it really were the Jews. But it wouldn't be fair for God to give the law, this precious law containing his will on which so much depends, if only one nation had the privilege of hearing it in their own language. And therefore the Jewish theory was that when God stood on Mount Sinai and gave the law, he spoke in 70 different languages. That's the same number that they had at Babel. And if you look further in the Jewish tradition, you'll find that the story is that that episode took place in the calendar, in the day in the calendar, which we call Pentecost. That's the Jewish view. It's tempting to put all these things together and to say, this story of Luke's, the author of Acts, with its definite background of the Pauline type of speaking with tongues, has here been reproduced in a slightly different form that we can understand what would lead to the production of this kind of a composite.